I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The gruesome and horrifying beheading of American journalist James Foley by Islamic State militants was posted on YouTube earlier this week. The images and the taunting message are chilling. The video threatened that another American journalist, Stephen Sotloff, would be killed if the U.S. bombing campaign against Islamic State continues. Yesterday, Foley's parents released an email they received from their son's kidnappers on August 12th. Saying their son would be killed in retaliation for U.S. airstrikes. We asked Matthew Van Dyke to join us. He met and got to know James Foley when he was in Libya and in Syria fighting with the rebels. And Matthew Van Dyke, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times, and I'm so sorry about the death of your friend.
Thank you.
How did you meet, how did you get to know James Foley?
I first met James in Libya in 2011. I've been held by a prisoner of war for about 6 months while fighting in Libya, and I escaped prison. And James had just returned to Libya after he had been released by the Gaddafi regime for being in prison for his journalism. So we bonded over that shared experience of having been imprisoned, although for two different things. But and we became roommates briefly in Tripoli, and then when I returned to combat on the front line soon after, James sometimes would go with me in my Jeep so he could do his reporting while I was fighting. And we just formed a friendship over these shared experiences, and that continued on, and then I was actually in Syria with him just a couple weeks before he was kidnapped.
So what was he like? What was he like as someone obviously in a dangerous situation with you and covering this sort of ongoing violence and unrest?
Yeah, he's somebody that truly cared about the people he was reporting on. It was more than a job to him. It was a real passion. You know, when he was in Syria, one of the hospitals didn't have ambulances. They were just putting people in the back of trucks and carrying them in wheelbarrows and things like this. And so James held a fundraiser online to buy an ambulance for the hospital. I mean, he really cared about the people that he was writing stories about. And at the same time, he was extremely professional, and he was cautious, and he did things the right way. And one of the scariest things is that if it could happen to somebody who was as professional as James, it could happen to anybody.
And when you say he did things the right way, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, especially after being detained by the Gaddafi government in Libya, he became understandably more cautious. And, you know, he did his research. He did check on sources and contacts and fixers. And he was careful in what he did. He was not reckless. He wasn't a cowboy type. He was a true professional.
There's actually Global Post has posted a number of his videos and also stories, some of his reports, both from Libya and from Iraq. And there is a video with you, Matthew, where he's sort of, you're walking through this prison where you were held in Libya, held in solitary confinement. And he's there talking to you, interviewing you, and documenting where you were. Can you talk a bit about that experience?
Yes, this was soon after I first met him, after I escaped from prison. I started, the press wanted to see my prison cell, and I think James actually was the first one that went with me back to that prison, perhaps. And I took him on a tour of the prison. He did the report for Global Post, and he was great. I mean, he had an understanding of it because he had been in a different Gaddafi prison. And it's, to this day, one of the best reports done on me, and he gave me the raw footage as well, the extra footage for me to have. Yeah, I mean, that, and I have video footage of him as well. He's actually in my film Point and Shoot. I insisted that he would be in that film because to honor him at that point, just knowing that he'd been kidnapped. I have footage of him from Libya and also from Syria. We would take video and photos of each other, you know, in between doing our work just to give to the other person. So we had some things to keep for our own memories.
And so many of the pictures of him shows him with a camera either around his neck or in his hand.
Yes, him working. I mean, James was, he was always working. He was up there on the front line. I mean, he was a journalist, just a journalist, a straight shooting journalist. You know, he and I were very different in what we do. I'm an activist, and Olivia was fighting, and he's a dedicated journalist. But even though we're different fields, we still have a friendship as people who work in conflict zones that have been through some tough times.
Hate to ask you this, but have you seen the photos or even the video of his beheading?
Yes, I watched the video reluctantly after being asked in interviews so many times if I'd seen it, so I thought I should watch it. Part of me wishes I had not watched it, because you can't unsee something. But, you know, it's shocking, and it's horrible, and it's a nightmare. And still seeing it on television every day, him in that orange clothing with the man next to him, it's absolutely horrific. Mm. And also for Stephen Sotloff, who's also a good friend of mine, to have both of their names in news reports about something in this context, something so awful, it's almost unbelievable.
It is unbelievable, and I have to say, I don't want to project too much, because I'm sure he was absolutely terrified, but having seen a photo of him standing in that very bleak desert landscape, he has a very, what I would describe as, stoic look on his face.
Right. Well, every, you know, reports of other prisoners who were with him, whose governments paid ransoms and got out, describe him as being tough to the end all the time, helping other prisoners, providing other prisoners with food and whatever they needed, negotiating with the guards for more provisions for other prisoners. I mean, James was tough. You know, he had the kindest heart, one of the kindest hearts of anybody I know. And at the same time, he was strong and he was courageous. I mean, this happened to somebody who was truly a wonderful human being, and that just adds to the tragedy of it. And in that video at the end, I mean, he has a calm look, I think, because he knew his family might see it, and he also didn't want to give in to his captors. He wanted to maintain his dignity and his strength, and he did to the very end, and it's incredibly admirable.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Matthew Van Dyke, and we're talking about James Foley, the video of his murder earlier this week posted on YouTube. Matthew Van Dyke was in both Libya and in Syria. He was fighting with the rebels, James Foley working as a journalist. How do you understand ISIS? What can you tell us about ISIS?
ISIS is a terrorist group on a level that we've never seen before. Their assets are in hundreds of millions of dollars. They're attracting recruits from all over the world, and they've actually managed to control territory, a large swath of territory spanning two countries in the heart of the Middle East. Now, this organization that did not even exist in Syria until spring of 2013, after James Foley was kidnapped. So he was kidnapped by another group that either splintered off and joined ISIS, or he was transferred to ISIS. But this is an organization that has driven Christians out of their homes in Iraq, has attempted a genocide against Yazidi people and other minorities, that does horrific atrocities, goes into a village, will cut people's heads off and put them on sticks to intimidate other people, levels of torture and chaos and murder that we just have not seen before. It's absolutely horrific. They need to be stopped as quickly as possible.
You did fight in Syria with rebel forces. Is there any way to know?
I fought in Libya, and I was filming and advising.
Okay, okay, my mistake there. I mean, do you feel like in your coverage in Syria that you might have been covering ISIS, but you didn't know it?
I actually lived in a building with people that later joined ISIS and didn't know it at the time. The building that I was in for about a month. It was at a time in October, November 2012. Jabhat al-Nusra had been formed. That was another group that was al-Qaeda, later deemed al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria. They were guarding part of the building, and the Free Syrian Army was guarding another part of the building, and they had this sort of uneasy kind of truce over this one building because it was a strategic location. And I was staying in that building at a media center. And I was told that later, when ISIS came on the scene, some of the members of Jabhat al-Nusra that were in that building with me joined ISIS.
Hmm.
But I never had any real interaction with them during that time, at least not any friendly interaction. They were actually a little irritated at me watching them do their exercises one time. And at another time, when I filmed a scene from my film of a girl standing on the rocks for the opening scene of the film, and they did not like that, an American filming a Syrian woman.
They did not like
with the camera. I mean, no. They came over and knocked my camera away and told me to get out of there.
On this audio or video, the audio on the video, the man who's beheaded James Foley has a British accent. What do you make of that?
ISIS has attracted a lot of foreign recruits. These are the Europeans and Americans they've recruited are, you know, first or second generation, usually children of immigrants who came from the region. And, you know, they're a lot of times depressed, angry youth that are looking for something greater or are not satisfied with the Western way of life. They may be extremists before they go to join ISIS. They may go to Syria originally, perhaps looking for adventure, looking for excitement, and then they join the extremist group and they gradually become indoctrinated. This British individual, he was apparently part of a trio that guards the foreign hostages. Apparently these are very brutal individuals, these three, and I have no doubt that the UK is going to be able to identify him based on his accent and what they know about the individuals who have left. And I hope that the harshest justice comes on this individual.
Why do they cover their faces?
Well, presumably he may intend to return to the UK at some point, and that's probably why.
I'm going to be talking with our guests who are waiting in the wings about this, but I have some ambivalence even talking about this because one wonders whether by even having a conversation or an interview about the Islamic State, we're feeding into their propaganda campaign.
Well, I think calling them the Islamic State is feeding into their propaganda campaign. I refuse to refer to them as the Islamic State. I refuse to acknowledge the existence of this entity that they claim to have established. You know, a country doesn't become a country until it's recognized by other countries. So, you know, I still call them ISIS. I think the Islamic State is a temporary phenomenon. Unfortunately, temporary could mean 2 or 3 years. It depends on the Western response, how strong the Western response is. But, you know, it's out there, and this in particular, what they've done here, the James, is not propaganda that serves them very well. I think it hurts them far more than it serves them. I mean, this sort of behavior would not convince even particularly very pious Muslims. I mean, this is behavior that's not condoned by Islam, that is not going to get them. Anybody sitting on the fence considering going to join ISIS is probably going to be repulsed and not join ISIS because of this video. So the only people it will impress are complete psychopaths who would want to join ISIS, and hopefully that's not very many people.
Yeah, hopefully not. Matthew, we're almost out of time here. Will you be going back to this region soon?
Yes, I'll be going to Iraq in the near future. I've launched a fundraiser on Indiegogo to raise money to help Christian refugees who were forced out of their homes by ISIS. And I'm working with a Christian activist on the ground in Erbil in Iraq, which is the city I lived in on and off for about 3 years, to make sure the funds are used properly and hopefully on a sustainable project to help the refugees.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, and I thank you very much, Matthew Van Dyke, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me and giving me the opportunity to tell people about James.
Absolutely. Talking about James Foley. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Chapin School, a pre-K through 8th grade independent school in Princeton, supports WHYY. With small classes and high academic expectations, Chapin students receive personal attention from a faculty dedicated to helping them succeed academically. Chapin's focus on the virtues of respect, responsibility, honesty, kindness, and perseverance seeks to nurture students with a strong moral fiber. Chapin students also demonstrate strong abilities in the arts, music, sports, and technology. More at chapinschool.org.
Hi, I'm Terry O'Reilly. The amazing Kreskin pops by Studio Q once again for a visit. The entertainer and mentalist is nearly 80 years old, and he's still a mesmerizing sort of character. The amazing Kreskin coming up on Q this summer from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. How did the world first find out about the stranded refugees on Mount Sinjar? From an Iraqi Kurdish media outlet you've probably never heard of.
Almost every TV station around the world, they contacted us and they asked for permission to use the videos.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. The United States has been carrying out airstrikes against ISIS militants even after the terrorist group posted a gruesome video on YouTube of the beheading of American journalist James Foley. ISIS has threatened to execute journalist Stephen Sotloff if the U.S. bombing campaign continues. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, said yesterday that ISIS has an apocalyptic end-of-days strategic vision that will eventually have to be defeated. So where did this group come from? Why have they been able to capture so much territory in Syria and in Iraq? Why are they so violent? What threat do they pose to the United States? Can they be defeated? How do they use social media? And should the U.S. pay ransom for captured Americans as other countries do? Many questions. Joining us is Philip Smythe, a researcher at the University of Maryland's Laboratory of Computational Cultural Dynamics and author of the blog called Hezbollah Cavalcade. Philip Smythe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Bobby Ghosh. He's managing editor of Quartz, a former editor and writer at Time Magazine, was Time's Baghdad bureau chief during the Iraq War. In fact, was a guest a number of times on Radio Times during that time. And Bobby Ghosh, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be back, Marty.
Nice to have you back. And Matthew Van Dyke said a very interesting thing, which is that he does not like the word Islamic State when describing these militants that beheaded James Foley. He says it's not a state, it's not a country, and we should not dignify them by calling them that. And I hate to begin with a semantic question, but to you, Bobby Ghosh, what do we call these people?
Well, I do feel the same way, but I think the train has left the station on that one. Whatever we choose to call them, ISIS, ISIL, both those abbreviations include the terms Islamic State. So one way or the other, we are calling them an Islamic State. I don't think there's any doubt in the minds of people who use the word here in the West and who hear us use the words that we are not talking about a nation. We're just talking about a terrorist group that happens to call itself a state.
And to you, Bobby Ghosh, only because you were in Iraq for all those years, how can, though, and it's numbered to be something like 17,000 people, how can 17,000 people, members of ISIS, conquer so much territory, terrorize so many people, and become the world's most notorious and even wealthiest terrorist group?
Well, there are two reasons for their success. One is that nobody has really put up a real fight against them. The Iraqi army, when they arrived in Mosul, the Iraqi army simply melted away. When they took Sinjar in the north, the Kurdish Peshmerga simply melted away. They chose not to stand and fight. The first time ISIS or ISIL has faced any serious firepower against them is in these past couple of weeks when they've had American airstrikes against them. And we've seen the impact of that. They've withdrawn from areas where they were previously entrenched. They gave up the Mosul Dam. So, you know, they haven't really faced serious opposition. The other reason is that their ranks, those 16,000 or 20,000, whatever the number is, include quite a lot of people with actual military experience. These are people who were in Saddam Hussein's old army, who were essentially disbanded by the American-led coalition authority after the war. Many of them went home, and many of them joined the old Iraqi insurgency, which over several years, parts of that insurgency morphed into what is today ISIS. There are senior commanders, majors, colonels, even some generals from Saddam's army who are in the ISIS command structure. There are people high up in ISIS who've been to war college. So they know strategy, they know the territory. This is their country for quite a lot of them. And finally, they've had the support of Sunni tribes and communities in northern Iraq, which don't necessarily subscribe to the ISIL worldview, but regard ISIL as an enemy's enemy because they are not happy with the Shiite-led government in Baghdad.
Philip Smythe, let me get you in on the conversation. And you have looked at this group's use of social media. I'm not sure if the word sophisticated is the right one, but how have they been able to get their message out?
Well, there have been a few different ways. They have a number of actually complicated Facebook networks. They have Twitter networks. I mean, some people have said, well, they don't have official pages. They're smart enough to understand how to kind of run the operation without having quote-unquote official pages. They have a number of different supporters that will put material out. And it's not just the brutal images. And I think that there's a lot of concentration now, and for obvious reasons, because of the brutal murder of Mr. Foley, that people will kind of hyper-concentrate on the brutality of it. And they put out a ton of stuff like that. But they also have another messaging strategy. At times on Twitter, they target Western analysts and try to get friendly with them. Other times, they'll post pictures of themselves, and I kind of constantly mock this. Their little pictures of them eating Nutella as if, hey, this is a humanizing factor. In many ways, I mean, I heard Mr. Van Dyke saying earlier that, you know, they get quite a bit of psychopaths. You know, they're trying to recruit psychopaths. And I mean, if you really look at it, it's this dual messaging strategy, which is rather psychopathic. On one hand, they're showing a beheading. On the other, they're saying, and you know, we're protecting the Muslim population. And we're just happy guys like you. And you know what? We even like Robin Williams. So, I mean, in terms of the narrative structure and how they're positioning it and how they are targeting certain people for this kind of message, that has been a sophisticated piece.
But would it be fair to say, Philip Smythe, that they do document everything? I mean, that they spend a lot of time sending out this information, but also documenting all the things that they've been doing since their rise to power.
In many cases, they've been putting up things since their rise to power. I mean, they came to power and they became a more independent organization right as, you know, social media was becoming greatly accepted in a number of different circles. And they have learned from different groups on how to use that medium to kind of push their message. So, yes, I mean, a lot of it's been recorded from the start.
Do you think, Bobby Ghosh, we are dealing with psychopaths when it comes to certainly the leadership of ISIS?
I have no doubt about it. It's not just the leadership. It's particularly, as we've seen, it's particularly true of many of the people who are the foot soldiers, if you like. I mean, I've said this before in other places. I think some of these fighters, particularly the guy who executed Jim, these people have more in common with the likes of Anders Breivik. And he's the guy in Norway who went and slaughtered all those children. Or the young man who in Sandy Hook who went into a school and slaughtered all those children. This is that kind of sort of bent minds that are at work here. The pleasure that they take from slaughtering people, most often people who are in no position to defend themselves. So prisoners of war, prisoners in general, women, the pleasure they take, the sheer enjoyment that you see in their videos and in their social media pronouncements, that speaks to a level of sadism that I have not encountered anywhere else.
Really? I mean, you've never seen that before? I mean, it has been said that Al-Qaeda rejects this group.
Well, yes, Al-Qaeda, but then Al-Qaeda has had several rounds of this, where this group began life 10 years ago, actually longer, but came into prominence 10 or 12, maybe 15 years ago now. And then during the U.S. occupation of Iraq, they were called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So Al-Qaeda embraced them, then rejected them, then embraced them again, and rejected them again. It's the high command of Al-Qaeda sort of has some qualms about this. But there are other elements of Al-Qaeda around the world which have ignored the high command and have essentially either applauded ISIS or have pledged allegiance to the commander of ISIS, a man who calls himself the Caliph.
Al-Baghdadi, yes?
Yes.
And again, Bobby Ghosh, managing editor of Quartz, a former editor and writer at Time Magazine, was Time Magazine's Baghdad bureau chief during the Iraq War. Also with us, Philip Smythe. He's a researcher at the University of Maryland's Laboratory of Computational Cultural Dynamics, author of the blog called Hezbollah Cavalcade. And we are talking about ISIS. We're talking about the murder, the beheading of James Foley, some of the challenges facing the Obama administration. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. To you, Philip, they talk about creating a caliphate. What do you see as the goal, the final mission of ISIS?
Well, it's essentially global domination through an Islamic state. That's exactly what they want. I've heard some people argue that their goals are a tad more regional, but I think from the imagery that they have produced and also just from the basic, you know, DNA of their ideology, it's, you know, a global mission that they have. Right now they want to pull people into al-Dawla, into the state, and that's essentially why they've been, you know, pulling in a lot of these foreign fighters, putting their passports away, burning their passports publicly. They're establishing the state, and now they're expanding the borders of it.
Bobby Ghosh, can they be defeated militarily?
Yes, they can be. It will take time. It will take a concerted effort. But yes, they can be defeated militarily. The first signs that we've seen, as I said, in northern Iraq with the U.S.-led airstrikes, that suggests that they can, that they're not some undefeatable, unvanquishable enemy. But defeating them will, they are quite a sophisticated operation, and defeating them will take sophisticated strategy. It's not a simple matter of sending more aircraft or more missiles down, raining down on them from the sky. It will require, they are multinational, so it will require a multinational effort.
Meaning a coalition forces, the United States, others?
Yes, indeed, and far more serious effort from the Iraqis themselves.
Do you see the U.S. with boots on the ground in Iraq, Bobby?
Well, I think that ship has sailed. We already have boots on the ground. We have troops in the air as well. I've always found it amusing when people say we have no combat troops in Iraq, but we have airstrikes. Well, the pilots on those planes are combat troops. Clearly, there's no appetite in this country to send tens of thousands of soldiers back into the Iraq, and perhaps it's not a good idea to do that anyway. But there is an Iraqi army, and it's quite a large army. And it needs to stand up. And there is the Peshmerga, and there are a number of countries in the neighborhood who have as much to fear from ISIS as we do. The Jordanians, the Kuwaitis, the Saudis, and so on.
I mean, who would want to live under ISIS, Bobby Ghosh?
Beg your pardon?
Who would want to live under ISIS?
No, very few people actually want to live under ISIS. Again, when they were known as Al Qaeda in Iraq, back in the mid 2000s, they showed in Iraq that their idea of ruling meant imposing a form of Islam that even the Taliban might consider a little extreme, and their former Iraqi allies eventually turned against them because it is so foreign, that notion of living like that is so foreign to Iraqis that it did not sit kindly with them. The Iraqi tribes aligned with them when it suited them, when it was convenient, as they are doing again now. But once they had achieved their aims, or felt that they were close to achieving their aims, they didn't want anything to do with the extremists, and with American help pushed them out. And I think that cycle will repeat itself. The one thing about these guys is that, you know, they learn from battlefield experience and improve their battle tactics. What they don't change at all is their vision of how the world should be organized and their relationships with the communities around them. You'd think after being rejected so many times by Muslim communities, they would have learned to become more accommodating or softer in their dealings with local people in some way, but they're not. They sooner or later they return to their original idea of sort of imposing this extreme worldview on people who don't want that.
Let me turn to you, Philip Smythe, on a related but different issue. The United States and Britain do not pay ransom for kidnapped citizens, and we know that some French and some Spanish people who were kidnapped by this organization, by ISIS, were released. Apparently, ransoms were paid. ISIS has demanded ransoms for Foley and for some other Americans being paid. Does it make any sense to pay a ransom in order to get back a captured citizen?
Well, I mean, this is a double-edged sword. This group has actually been making a ton of money from these kidnaps, and they understand how lucrative it can be. I for one, and I really can't speak for policy because I'm not a policymaker, But I can tell you, you know, that would only encourage that sort of behavior. Though, you know, as an American citizen, I'm willing to kind of do anything to get an American citizen.
Sure.
You know, negotiating with these people and giving them cash and giving them the means to continue their war effort because they've captured one of our citizens or captured, you know, a European citizen, it doesn't really strike, you know, it doesn't really strike a good chord with me.
Well, and to you, Bobby Ghosh, I mean, does it make sense then for the West to have some kind of, or other countries that have captured citizens, to have a united front in dealing with ISIS?
I don't think we're ever going to be able to have a united front on this because, let's face it, I mean, an elected government, an elected politician, elected ruler, coming under enormous pressure to save the life of one of his countrymen is going to respond to his own heart and to his own sense of what makes the most tactical and strategic sense at any given time. So to try and impose an international rule on this would be difficult. I mean, the United States has been consistent. A number of American presidents have, unfortunately, come to this place and faced this challenge and have decided to stick with the American policy on this, and that has worked to some degree. Mm. On the other hand, the picture is not as clear as all that. Yes, we know that, for instance, the Italians pay ransom, but there's no proof that that these terrorists are looking specifically for Italians to kidnap. There is not a preponderance of Italian hostages. So it's quite a lot of this kidnapping is opportunistic. An opportunity arises, they grab the person. They don't know when they're, quite often, they have no idea when they're grabbing somebody, whether that person is American or Italian. They just see someone who looks like a foreigner, possibly someone who's white, and they grab them. And then there's a discussion afterwards about what to do, whether they can reasonably extract money, or if not, whether they can use this person for prisoner exchanges, as we saw in the case of Bo Bergdahl in Afghanistan, or whether they should use this person for some sort of demented propaganda purposes, as we saw with poor Jim.
And we're almost up in a break here, but Bobby, I mean, it seems to be fair to say that some of this money, this ransom that has been paid, has helped ISIS then acquire weapons and all that they've used to run roughshod over these two countries.
Yes, it certainly has. It's also worth remembering the vast majority of people they kidnap are not foreigners at all. They're local people. And the amounts they collect, although they add up to a considerable amount, are small amounts. The other side of that same coin is, yes, giving ISIS money strengthens them. But there are plenty of people who are arguing that releasing 5 senior Taliban prisoners from Guantanamo strengthens the Taliban.
That's Bobby Ghosh, again, managing editor at Quartz, a former editor, writer at Time Magazine, was Time's Baghdad bureau chief during the Iraq War. Also with us, Philip Smythe, and he's a researcher at the University of Maryland's Laboratory of Computational Cultural Dynamics, author of the blog called Hezbollah Cavalcade. And we are talking about ISIS. We are talking about the beheading, the death, the murder of journalist James Foley. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Tickets are available for Alan Ayckbourn's Intimate Exchanges, starring Jennifer Childs and Anthony Lawton. A part of the 2014 Philadelphia Fringe Arts Festival, Intimate Exchanges features 8 possible outcomes and puts the audience in charge of the story. This award-winning comedy plays August 28th through September 21st at the Arcadia Stage in Arden Theater in Old City. Tickets and info at 1812productions.org.
A new box set collects 16 films that director Werner Herzog made between 1970 and 1999, including Fitzcarraldo, A Gare, The Wrath of God, and Nosferatu the Vampire. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Herzog, and John Powers reviews the box set. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Matthew Weiner remembering the Mad Men good old days of the 60s.
It is the height of America's influence, of America's goodwill. There is this feeling, I think, that this is the way the world is going to be.
Weiner on history, memory, and his new relationship movie, Are You Here? Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with journalist Bobby Ghosh, managing editor of Quartz, and Philip Smythe from the University of Maryland about the rise of ISIS and some of the tough choices facing the president. And we are also taking phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Philip, before we get to our callers, just I want to go back to you about the kind of social media campaign used by ISIS, and I wonder what is an effective social media campaign sort of in response to their propaganda. How would that work?
Well, I think, again, there are two sides to this. As one who monitors them on social media, just from a research capacity, I want to see them continue to put stuff up. The same thing goes for certain intelligence agencies that are around here that are targeting these people. The more they put up, the merrier, because it helps put together a picture about them. But if we're dealing with propaganda, I think, you know, the some of this material which is promoted and passed around, there's a certain kind of hipster factor about it. And look, I can have a conversation with an IS member, and I can put up their stuff, and I can do this, and I can do that. This is kind of a deeper philosophical question. Do you really want to spread this? Do you really, want to encourage this kind of material? It's one of those complicated matters. But in terms of strategy, I'm looking at the banning strategy that's going on Twitter right now, as are experts like J.M. Berger. Now, J.M. Berger and I have kind of discussed this, and I've read a lot of the stuff that he's been putting out, and he would say, yes, banning certain accounts is affecting their ways of kind of promoting this material. However, having seen how they behaved before on Facebook and on Twitter, they're going to just replicate many of these accounts and continue to put things up. They're a dynamic group like any other. So it makes matters very, very complicated. I'm kind of left at times holding my hands up. I'm not going to spread their stuff on a personal level. I'm not going to do that. I don't think others should, but if you're going to completely black things out, it may actually put, the emperor on some collection activities.
Well, and even picking up on that and thinking about this, horrific video, I can imagine that could definitely work against ISIS when you see just what they did to Foley and what they are threatening to do to another American journalist.
Well, of course. It does have that kind of a blowback effect. And part of me would have thought that before. Part of me kind of still does, that it does have that very negative effect. But then there's also a positive effect for IS. And if we remember, the Iraqi army and internal security forces, when they really started to peel off and they started to run from Mosul, it wasn't simply because they had poor logistics. It wasn't simply because they had bad commanders who left. But there was also a really nasty fear factor, a very real fear factor. IS was going around in, when they were still ISIS, we're still executing people and then filming it, wholesale and putting it right back up on Twitter. It goes two ways. And I think this is a big problem, but it's not just the brutality bit. I brought up earlier, when they put up pictures of themselves, snickering and eating Skittles and all this other kind of material, I feel it's just as nefarious. So, it kind of gets you back to square one. How do you really deal with this? Right. How do you not humanize this group? How do you treat them like an enemy? How do you get rid of them? And it's a very complicated matter.
Indeed. Bobby, do you want to weigh in on that, and then we'll get to our callers?
Well, the thing is that, look, these people are trying to reach two different audiences. The more important audience from their point of view are their fellow travelers, people who might be tempted to join them or support them in one fashion or the other, who feel about the world the way they feel. To that group, they can reach that group without our help, basically, and they've done so for years, and they will continue to do so for years, and efforts to block that have never really worked, and I'm not optimistic that they can be blocked. I think that trying to block the I think Twitter is right to prevent that video from being shown. I think that reflects the values of the rest of the world, and we should cling to our values. But let's not sort of pretend that there are any realistic chance of completely stopping the propaganda campaign that they have launched. And I think it's right for us to be cognizant of it, and to it's a horrible burden for those who have to watch these things. But there are people in American law enforcement and in the military who need to watch these things so that they know what kind of enemy they're going to be dealing with. And the rest of us have to be aware that these videos exist, even if we don't necessarily have to see them, because we too have to know the nature of the enemy that exists out there.
Let me get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about ISIS. We are talking about the murder of American journalist James Foley and the threat of murdering another journalist, Stephen Sotloff, if the U.S. bombing campaign continues in Iraq. It is continuing, raising, of course, a whole host of questions. Let me get Sarah from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, guys, I just wanted to thank you first for taking the time to talk about James Foley. I actually went to graduate school with him. We were together in Washington, D.C. at Northwestern's McGill School back in 2007, and I can't tell you how much this man had a passion for what he did. He was Jim to us back then, but he is probably the most dedicated, hardest-working reporter I've ever known. He dedicated his life to press, and this was just, for those of us in the journalism community, such a huge loss. But what I was curious about, and what really has struck me in the days since the video was released, is just how many friends of mine, Americans, people who just pay attention to the news, have shared the video themselves on their Facebook pages, on Twitter. It's almost like we've become desensitized, and in a way, we as a culture see these videos and feel the need to pass them on. It's made grieving, I think, that much harder for Foley's family, certainly for those of us who knew him. And I think beyond humanizing ISIS, it's been another effect that I guess certainly didn't see coming, and I'm just curious what you guys all think about that angle of things.
Well, Sarah, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and thank you for sharing your experiences knowing James Foley. Philip Smythe, she's concerned about people sharing these videos. I'm sure there are many, probably most good intentions in sharing them, but nonetheless sort of feeling as if something is lost there in the mourning process.
Well, first, I mean, I'm very sorry for her loss, you know, of a classmate and somebody who influenced her. But secondly, yes, there is a very big desensitization process which is kind of going on. You can kind of read this many different ways. You can read it from a more emotional angle, you know, what does this do to his family? But you know what, I mean, this kind of material has been coming out for quite a while. Mm-hmm. We now have ease of access to it. Anyone, yourself included, can go on Twitter and find this in about 5 seconds. I can go on Facebook and find it in about 2. This is kind of what adds up, and eventually this starts to occur. I don't really know if there's a way to defeat that. I don't really know if there's a way to defeat that process. It's a very, very tough situation.
Yeah, what do you think, Bobby?
Yeah, I really don't know either. It's hard to escape the coarsening of public life. It's hard to escape the fact that we are seeing so much violence. And I don't want to blame Hollywood. That's too easy. We are seeing so much violence on the news every day. And a desensitization, I suspect, is inevitable. It's just human nature. We can wring our hands about it, we can wail about it, but I don't think that we can change it very much. The best we can do is teach our children to make judgments based on good and bad, good and evil, the traditional way that judgments ought to be made, and prepare them for a world in which they will be seeing far more gruesome things than we were brought up to expect.
Sarah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And again, you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We have an email from Danielle. Wouldn't it serve the U.S. to support Turkey, perhaps by doing so the Muslims could find a safe haven, refuge from ISIS and other malicious factions? I'm going to toss that back to you, Bobby Ghosh, because you know this region so well. Is that a helpful way to think of this crisis?
It's a very simplistic way of thinking of this crisis. I don't think it's very helpful. These are very sophisticated groups, their histories are quite complex and don't lend themselves to easy explanations. The solutions to them won't be that easy either. They require resolve, but they also require sophistication and subtlety on our part. And that's very hard. It's hard for a country to behave in a subtle fashion. The history of the world suggests that very few countries have ever managed to do that. But it doesn't help to try to. Although I understand the human instinct to try and simplify things, in this instance, it doesn't help.
Well, Philip, this is a question which is in Syria. ISIS had been fighting against Assad. Assad is the enemy of the United States. Now there's a question about Assad and the United States being on the same side against ISIS. And I don't know whether, you know, that enemy of my enemy is my friend makes any sense in this region of the world. But I'd be curious about the choices, I guess, facing the United States. The U.S. apparently doesn't see Assad as an ally at all in this conflict. But how do you see it?
Well, you know, speaking of hyper-simplistic solutions, exactly. That would be an example of one. Siding with Assad. And that would also mean the tacit approval of other terrorist entities, namely Hezbollah, Qatar Hezbollah, and, you know, a multitude of other Shia groups backed by the Iranians, which have targeted and killed Americans. So, this is a multipolar environment. It's very complicated. I think at the end of the day, and this is the conversation that I will have with colleagues in D.C., because it's a multipolar battlefield, that means we need to state what our end goals are. We need to be manipulative at times. We need to coerce certain entities. This is tough. This is very, very tough. And frankly, I don't think Assad would be a very, very good guy to have on our side to do this. He hasn't been able to defeat these forces. There have been, other activist claims, but also other more kind of normal journalistic claims that have demonstrated that, Assad's campaign against ISIS, has not really been the most effective, possibly deliberately, because it does serve as a narrative builder for the Assad regime to paint all of their rebel foes as members of this extremist organization. So, we're kind of building up a very, very complicated ball of wax here. I would say, this is just a personal view. This is not even something I write in a policy piece, but the United States just kind of needs to put its foot down and, these are our goals, this is what we want, and if we have to use force, we're going to use it.
Mm. To you, Bobby, the president has been criticized for not getting involved and arming the Syrian rebel forces fighting against Assad. This goes back a year or two. I don't know if there's any way to roll back the clock to know whether that was a right decision or a wrong decision. Would we be talking about ISIS if the United States had intervened sooner or intervened at all in Syria?
It is hard. Historical counterfactuals are hard, but there were plenty of people at the time who were warning about this. This is not the benefit of 2020 vision alone. There were many people who, even when the president was making the decision not to arm the, at that time, mostly secular nationalistic opposition to Assad, who were warning that an American failure to participate, to help, would open the way for more extremist groups. So I think the administration can't sort of wriggle out of this one and say, nobody knew at the time.
Yeah.
People knew at the time, prominent people knew at the time, and they were warning that this would happen.
Well, in fact, earlier this year, President Obama dismissed ISIS as a kind of a junior varsity team.
Yeah, that I think is the equivalent of, I'm sorry to say, that is the equivalent of George Bush saying bring it on, George Bush Jr. saying bring it on to the Iraqi insurgency after the fall of Saddam Hussein. I think that is or actually further back with other terrorist groups. I think that kind of language doesn't help. Minimizing our enemy doesn't help us take the right kinds of actions against them. And politically, that's a bad idea because he basically communicated to the American public that this was not a serious threat. And now finds himself, as we saw yesterday from administration officials, find himself having to send out the opposite message to say, no, these are not the JV. This is the most dangerous terrorist group we have ever encountered. So for the President of the United States to go within a matter of a few weeks from one extreme to the other just shows the difficulty of political communications.
Philip, about a minute before we have to say goodbye to the two of you, what will you be looking for in the next couple of weeks then?
In terms of kind of propaganda material?
Propaganda material.
I tend to look at everything because everything adds up to a broader narrative. And I do kind of want to see their activities online and see how affected they actually were from a lot of this counteractivity, which has been going on recently. And also, if this activity is going to really continue. I mean, hashtag activism is not really all that effective. And often when stories fade from the limelight, people tend to forget and then go back to their old behaviors.
And how about for you, Bobby?
Yes, we'll all be watching very closely with a mixture of horror and curiosity to see what these people do next. But if history is any judge, the next atrocity will be worse than this one. And I'm keeping my fingers crossed for all of the many people who are their captives. It's worth mentioning at this point that the vast majority of them are not Westerners; they are locals, Syrians, Iraqis. Mm-hmm. And I fear for them, and I hope for the best.
Me as well. Bobby Ghosh, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Happy to be here.
And he's managing editor of Quartz. And Philip Smythe, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
Researcher at the University of Maryland's Laboratory of Computational Cultural Dynamics, author of the blog Hezbollah Cavalcade. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter. You can also download a podcast of the program and sign up for our weekly newsletter. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.